All right, so for today, we've chosen the boring topic, finally. Okay, I thought I couldn't one-up myself. You know, homosexuality is pretty edgy. You know, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty cutting edge. You know, even my students hesitate before talking about this topic. You know, they'll talk about, you know, these are, you know, students talk about anything these days. But this is already cutting edge to some degree, even in the wider community. And so for the Orthodox community, as we say, kal vachomer, all the more so. This is, again, we're going to do this. I'm learning about these topics myself. I'm going to present some of the things that I've learned. But just like homosexuality, these are still a work in progress. I'm still kind of processing and thinking through the ramifications of these issues and really where I think that the modern Orthodox community needs to move on these kinds of questions. So these are questions I'm thinking about very actively right now. But again, I don't have fully formed opinions on them per se, but I will share a little bit. I have not, as opposed to homosexuality, where I have not only many, or I would say many, but a number of friends that I grew up with who later came out as homosexuals. Transgenderism, I have not had that, I have not had that experience. I have also not had anyone come to me directly for counseling around these things, so it's not something that I've encountered in quite that way. One way in which I did encounter recently was an episode that I decided to weigh in on. I don't usually quote myself or put myself on the sheet, but I did this just by way of sharing a little bit of autobiographical information a little bit more recently. There is one of the challenges on campus is for student groups to invite guest speakers. And in religious environments, it creates a whole new set of considerations. So at Yeshiva University, this is a complex issue, as it is on many college campuses. Freedom of speech, and the administration doesn't want to interfere. You want to allow for a certain kind of freedom for students to invite their own speakers, but sometimes there are ramifications to the speakers that students choose to invite. So Yeshiva University has a Democratic political club, they have a Republican political club, and the Republican club, I think, had not been so active, and they decided that they wanted to become a little bit more active, and they decided to bring some attention. So if you want to bring some attention to your group and your students' group, so what you do is you invite an inflammatory speaker and hope that lots of people show up. Apparently they learned this trick of the trade, and there were some students at Yeshiva University, and I don't think that they represent of a very large group or a much larger group, but there was a small group of students at Yeshiva University that invited an individual by the name of Ben Shapiro to speak. Anyone familiar with the name Ben Shapiro?
Commentator?
He's a far-right political commentator who wears a kippah on his head.
Right. He's on Fox News occasionally.
And by the way, I'm not one to get embroiled in politics. It's not my style. It's not my point of emphasis per se. But I will say that when I find that people on either end of the political spectrum say things that are primarily for laughs and primarily to simply sell themselves, right, as entertainment, because that's really what gets out there. That's what breaks through these days. It's really the structure of social media and the internet era and the privatization of the information age has really, I think, fostered an environment where there's good incentive for people to be extremists, not in terms of their activities, but at least in terms of their political rhetoric. So Ben Shapiro apparently has learned this, and he is a real right-wing rabble-rouser. And again, I don't typically call people out, but frankly, he's an individual. The way that he speaks and the language that he uses is deeply distressing to me. It's very upsetting, and I think it's completely unacceptable. He's like my age, just a kid. He's younger than me. Sorry.
You said it, not me.
Just joking. He's young. He's even younger than I am.
30-something.
He's young 30s.
Young,
yeah. Young 30s. But, and a lot of others, the whole group of these, again, on both ends of the political spectrum. And the guy goes from campus to campus and just says the darndest things to get attention. And one of the things that he did at this talk at Yeshiva University is he referred to an incident in which he had mocked a transgender individual in the middle of an interview. He refuses, if let's say someone, again, just to define terms at the outset, for our purposes, a transgender person is someone who it's not that there is ambiguity in terms of their physical characteristics or anything like that. We have that in halakha, we have that in history, we have that in medicine, and androgynous, something along those lines. That's not what this is. A transgender is someone who is born with a particular set of physical characteristics that clearly identifies that person as one gender, but they live life with an experience feeling that they are the opposite gender. Male to female, female to male, either way. The incidence of this in our society is estimated somewhere between 0.3 and 0.6%. So we're talking about a very small, much smaller than the homosexual community by all measures, by all statistical studies, but a significant minority of our community that has, and I think it's taken a little bit more time to garner more attention, but at this point is allied with the LGBT community, obviously, just by the very definition of the term, and has gotten the word out there. Ben Shapiro refuses, as a matter of philosophical principle, to recognize that an individual's identity is determinative in terms of the gender one should be, which I think is philosophically a highly plausible position. In other words, I'm born of a certain set of anatomy, I have a certain set of physical characteristics, I feel a different way. So he insists that the fact that I feel a certain way, or that even if that's my soul, my heart is telling me the opposite, even through no fault of my own, but nonetheless, a person is born a certain gender, that's who they are. And that's a major culture war in our time, you know, from the bathrooms. I just saw there was news, the Trump administration is talking about changing the policy. These are really difficult live issues, and not just at Targets, but in lots of places around the country, on college campuses, etc. Having a philosophical position on that is something that I think one ought to have. That's a good thing if you're a thoughtful, intelligent individual and you've come to a considered opinion. I think that's a really important thing. What I think is unacceptable is mocking anyone, is to get up in front of a public audience to score points by calling out someone who has clearly struggled for their entire lives with these kinds of things. And that's exactly what Shapiro does for a living. That's how he makes his living. And again, it's not on one side or the other, but it's, I think there's an incentive for people to do that. That's kind of how he's out there. In the middle of his talk at Yeshiva University, which I only saw afterward on YouTube, in response to a question, he referred to an incident in which he had this conversation with someone up on stage. I don't know if anyone saw this at any point, and he basically mocked this Zoe Tour, who is a transgender journalist, and insisted upon calling that person by their initial gender, despite the gender change. So, for example, I gave it to you in Source 1, just a quick summary. In a heated panel discussion Thursday on the HLN television show, it's like a year and a half ago, Dr. Juan Cole Shapiro said, "Why are we mainstreaming delusion?" Right? So, in other words, he's saying the language is already, is quite high-pitched. Right? Why are we mainstream delusion? Later, the entire discussion is whether we're embracing mental illness and delusion as a society. In fairness, if you look, there's actually a good deal of medical research and research in general. What are the causes of transgenderism? And there is a live debate as to whether this is viewed as a mental illness or not. It's probably not surprising for us to hear that the winds are starting to move away from that, but it's still in DSM-5, which is the sort of determinative work in terms of identifying mental illnesses. I believe it remains there, and that's the general practice. The most recent one. I think it's still there. And there's real research around this. This is not, and there's actually the name of this dysfunction is gender dysphoria. Not everyone who's a transgender experiences dysphoria. Dysphoria means that I have this sense that mental, I'm not, obviously it's not my area, but my understanding is that the mental health professionals view it as a disorder when it interferes in some significant way with my daily functioning. So as opposed to judging it, because otherwise we're going to end up having this philosophical debate. But at the moment that it interferes with living my life in the way that I would like to live it, that's where it's often considered to be that. And not everyone who identifies transgender is necessarily troubled to that extent, although the majority are. So most individuals who identify as transgender experience gender dysphoria as a dysfunction, and that's still viewed in the mental health community as a disorder, as a mental health illness. So it's not an implausible position, but again, the point was not just to make a philosophical point, it was to rip into someone and to mock and make light of a very challenging and serious issue, which I think is completely unacceptable. Shapiro insisted on referring to the Olympics athlete and reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner, who recently came out as transgender, right? So that helps to date this, so again, about a little more than a year ago, by male pronouns. He did the same with Zoe Tour, transgender journalist on the panel with Shapiro. Tour warned Shapiro to stop or go home in an ambulance. Okay, so Zoe, he got to Zoe Tour. You can understand why, although on national TV it wasn't necessarily the most appropriate of responses either. But, you know, it's also what happens. But whatever. It was unfortunate on all sides. The internet has been abuzz with commentary, much of an angrily critical Shapiro. On Friday, Tour agreed with a Twitter user who said he would pay to see her curb stomp Shapiro. Tweets have since been deleted, which is obviously also unacceptable. I was disappointed that YU had invited this individual to speak. It was not the institution YU, to be very, very clear. It was a student group at YU. And by the way, for the record, I'm not opposed necessarily to the policy of YU not to interfere with the student group extending an invitation to a controversial speaker. That is a Pandora's box. That is a very serious issue. And then, right, if you start, right, you disinvite one person, or you can have a conversation with the organizers, you can explain to them as educators what the ramifications might be, and even how it might impact the perception of the university, because inevitably people who are not on the inside of any institution will tend to conflate, right? The less connected they are, the more will say, oh, institution X invited speaker X, where actually it was a student group, not the administration or another, you know, or a faculty member or what have you. These are very different scenarios, but people tend not to know that. So educationally, I think there could be a value in speaking about and explaining what the implications might be, but I don't think that why you necessarily made a mistake by permitting a student group to invite a speaker of their choosing. I was just disappointed in the student group. I thought it was a poor choice. I think it's totally legitimate for there to be such a club and for them to invite stimulating speakers, but as soon as it just goes off the end and it's just about making fun of people, you've lost the whole opportunity for critical thinking, you've lost the opportunity for enlightenment, and you've brought dark instead of lightness to extremely important communal matters that really are not about vileness and about shaming others. So I wrote a little piece. You can take a look. I gave it to you here.
Oh, this is your letter?
I submitted this to the student newspaper at Yeshiva University. I put it up online.
Was it printed?
You know, I was very annoyed at them. They did not print it. I was very annoyed. They said that they very much enjoyed the letter, but they had so many, they were swamped with letters that they were not able to print it. It's not that they did, and to their credit, they printed a number of very similar letters, and I was a little late to the game, in fairness. So I don't think that they intentionally chose not to, and they were a very nice email apologizing and explaining. But these days, it's not all that important, because I just posted it online and went viral immediately. So it's like, you just, I mean, that's just the nature of modern media, right? And that's how it works, right? And that's those are the ideas that are winning, is people who know how to leverage modern media. It's a very interesting and new world. So it went around. It was spread out quite broadly. So you can take a look at that. But I think the most important thing for us to say, as you can take a look at that, is that these are very challenging, important, sensitive matters, and as not just as members of society, of an American society, but as committed Jews, as committed halachic Jews, you know, there's no room for anything like this. This is against everything that halacha legislates. Mocking an individual who is struggling, who is suffering, that's despicable behavior, and it's against every fundamental tenet of what the Torah tells us. It's a religious matter, to my mind. It's very simple. So this is these are very serious issues. And by the way, I would add that the whole story, without assigning blame, but I know I'm making up a word, but the celebritization of Jenner around these events brought attention to this matter, but also made it into a circus a little bit. And I'm not sure that that's the healthiest way for us to have a discourse. Sometimes something inflammatory needs to happen in order for our attention to be drawn to certain events. The civil rights movement is exemplary of that, and so on. But, you know, I think these require real sober conversation and real reflection. So I'm not sure that that's really quite the right way. Okay. All right. Moving things along, I gave you in source 3 at the bottom of page 10 just a dictionary definition of transgenderism, but it's essentially what I said, right? Transgenderism, of relating to or being a person whose gender identity differs from the sex the person had or was identified as having at birth, especially of relating to being a person whose gender identity is opposite the sex the person had or was identified as having at birth. Right. By the way, the term transsexual had been used as well. It's no longer, I think, in vogue. This is a term that was coined in maybe the mid-70s, I think, transgenderism, roughly, as a term. 60s at the earliest.
No, I thought it was
even
recent.
Later. Well, maybe it was late 70s, whatever. I was looking at it. These are fairly, this is fairly recent language. We're talking about maybe 40 years old at most. Initially, there was a term transsexual that was used as well. That's now understood to refer more to, in terms of one's physical or intimacy, those matters, rather than just simply one's identity in terms of one's gender, which is broader than sexual activity. It goes without saying. But even the language that one uses, if one's not within that community, interacting with members of that community on a regular basis, so often you don't even know that language. And sometimes there's so much sensitivity, one could argue that it's too far. Sometimes everyone's looking to catch you. And sometimes we live in that world also, where it's like, anything you say, like, as opposed to, like, if you're in goodwill, like, we're still learning about this, right? Civilization is how many years old, right? And how recently are we actually having real conversations about these things? Like, in that context of a serious, mature, you know, reflective conversation about these issues, and maybe accidentally use the wrong word isn't necessarily intentional. It's not necessarily in order to stir the pot. It might just be people are learning. But that's
well,
just in terms of the language.
You know, because of...
No problem.
Because of the prohibition, biblical prohibitions, you know, distinguishing Jews from others. Mm-hmm. Others clearly practiced these things. So, you know, it was once obviously some kind of a norm.
Well, transgenderism is not explicitly outlawed in the Torah. We're going to talk to, you know, that there's no... In fact, transgenderism is just what I'm experiencing. I haven't done anything necessarily. What? We'll talk about that. But I want to clarify that even being a transvestite is different. Now, obviously, there's a lot of overlap with this, but in terms of incidents. But it's not exactly identical with transvestite behavior either. And we don't know how prevalent that was in that society. So we will talk about it. It's important. It's also ironically relevant on Purim. Purim is the one day a year.
You get to do whatever.
but this, by the way, this theme of appearance and reality and so on is actually, right, is quite pertinent to the whole Purim story. So I think it's our timing is, I don't want to say a pre-Purim shiur on transsexuality. That's a little true, transgenderism too. But, and it's a little much. But, okay. It's important to know that people who experience this, although we can debate nature and nurture, and there's been a lot of research around these questions, just like there has been for homosexuality, but it's important to know that the bottom line is, wherever it comes from, that people who experience gender dysphoria are often suffering. I think I mentioned this last week, but I gave you the recent research on suicide rates, 41% reporting that in one way or another they tried to kill themselves. That's a stunningly high percentage as compared with the general population, which according to this study was put at 4.6%. I know, right? That's just... I don't know, there's a joke, but I don't know what it is. About the music in the background.
Background music for the topic, is that what you mean?
What? I'm not sure that quite fits. Anyhow, so these are very, very serious challenges, obviously. There was a blog in the Huffington Post about the some of the causes of this, trying to understand why is it that such individuals would tend to have especially high suicide incidences of suicidality. First of all, right, if you think about it for just a moment, I think we can understand, right? I mean, imagine for ourselves that we were sitting here today, right now, right? And we felt that we were literally living a lie, right? That we were literally not ourselves. Yeah, if you don't mind, just, yeah. At the very least. This is our new construction on this side is for our new music center. Get excited, everyone. I don't think this is going to remain my office in 2 years' time. So, in fact...
In fact,
I think I'm going to be right above the music center. There are two options. That's the leading option right now. So, but it won't just be me. They'll be if I'm there, it's part of the entire development suites, and I'd be together with them. So
it's going to be up there. They're going to do some soundproofing.
Yeah, that would be the plan. I've been begging for... a couple of years already here, so we'll see what happens. Hopefully,
if they can leave some instruments around here, so at least we can join in.
That's right. I mean, like it's right. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, it's gonna run there. Yeah.
One way or another. Right now, they're just mocking us. So, guys, if you want, we can. I mean, I can have Sheridan come in. And
yeah.
I'm happy to do it. He's awesome. Okay. Yeah. So, just. Right. Imagine for a moment if we would put a right could begin to imagine what it's like to walk around feeling that we're living a lie. You know, and then there's the even if everyone was as generous and kind to us as humanly possible, but then we'd walk in and we wouldn't know which restroom to use, or someone we'd know, or just assume that people are looking at us funny. And then imagine we're in an Orthodox setting and we go to daven, right? And we're religiously committed and we want to come daven on a regular basis. We're just walking into school or what have you. I mean, like these are incredibly difficult kinds of experiences. Imagine someone undergoing, and then on top of it, society doesn't always know what to do and how to respond and what is sensitive. Even the best of intention people don't necessarily know what to do or act in a way that's useful and supportive. Very often, there's and I give you here that if you look at the headings in the article, right? So it's rejection by friends and family. There was someone who, right? I mean that's probably the most dramatic thing in the literature. Is the sense if I feel the more that I feel supported by my friends and family, the lower the incidence of suicidality and vice versa, as you would expect. If there's experience of discrimination, again, what that means and what that looks like. Because, by the way, these questions are complicated. It's not a simple matter for someone who says, I identify as a female, right, to walk looking as a male into the women's restroom as a society. These are incredibly complex matters. And I think that there are legitimate debates to be had around these issues. And I don't think that it's obvious that having a third restroom option or sending a child to the faculty restroom, which some schools I've seen who've had this issue, like public schools and the like, have recommended as an alternative to the Obama administration's policy, that's not always so simple either, for lots of obvious reasons, right? You're the kid who's always going to the different restroom. But at the same time, you understand
your
discomfort.
And they are like,
right. Or even if it's a one person one, but right. But right, I mean there aren't necessarily obvious solutions. So you can understand there are really legitimate challenges that this really does raise for us as a society. But the unnecessary discrimination or not thinking, I would say it's not sufficient that we not discriminate. I think it's necessary for us to be proactive in thinking about some of these challenges in society. And just as we would say, well, if we're thinking about an individual with, not to call this a disability, but let's say we're thinking about someone who had a physical disability, and we would say, rightly so, and law dictates that it's not sufficient to say, well, when someone who is a cripple walks into your school, shul, whatever, that you need to then say, oh, you know, we should let's figure out the best way to handle it. No, we need to be proactive, right? There needs to be something that's in place, solutions that we've considered at the outset when you build your structures, right? When you build your building and so on, create your community. So here as well. There's physical abuse. There's a higher incidence of physical abuse. There's being seen as transgender, and so on and so forth. And all these kinds of things, and someone who's in a community that's not comfortable talking about these things or handling these things in a direct way increases the rate of suicidality, and it's a challenge for a traditional community. Any traditional community will be more inclined to, on the one hand, uphold sometimes very legitimate and important cultural norms. I think that that's extremely important value that traditional communities have to offer. The flip side is that they can be difficult places to have conversations that might be normalized in the wider society, and that's not just in a question of culture. That's a question of human life, and that's a question of, you know, how likely it is for someone to survive through their teenage years or what have you. I mean, these are life and death issues. So an ability to have a real conversation around things is obviously crucial as well. So it's not easy. Where does it come from? So again, there is some research, significant research that's been developing. They have found actually a genetic correlation with regard to this, and also differences in hormonal balance, which you might expect between someone who identifies as the same gender and identifies as a different gender. But the former piece is actually interesting. Is less obvious that there's that they have. They're still doing the studies. They're relatively new. These are studies from 2002, 2004, 2006, 2008. So these are things that are, you know, ongoing as we speak over the last decade or two. But they have begun to find studies that have confirmed earlier studies that found certain genetic predispositions to this. So it's clearly a nature element. You know, the nurture question is always out there. It's pretty clear that that there are some cases in which people who undergo certain kinds of either traumas or what have you do have a higher incidence, but it's also quite clear that that's not sufficient to account for the whole thing. I haven't heard people walk around and say that it's a choice. I haven't been hearing that. But again, these are challenges that are not dissimilar to the homosexuality conversation.
There's a plastic surgeon that lives in my condominium, and he actually specializes in gendered operations for a long time, and he's a leading expert.
But there are only so many in the country.
Yeah, well, he's.
They do like a 1,000 a year, I think, on average now.
Yeah.
That's not so many.
So he said that autopsies have been done on some transgender people, and they have found that something in their brain, I don't know, the part of the brain that contributes to gender identification
is also different.
So
there's a neurological element as well.
Right.
And that's fascinating. Do you know if that's been correlated with the genetic piece or the hormonal piece? Do we know?
He just mentioned that one. I could easily ask him.
Yeah.
But so when people say, I feel like a woman, even though I feel like a female, even though I have male equipment, they're not delusional. Something in their brain is telling them that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's
another piece.
Another piece.
Thank you very much.
It could also be brain development also. I'm just wondering.
You know, yeah, where it came from, what
the brain is malleable. The brain development is malleable.
It's malleable. That's just what could be possibly certain drugs. Mm-hmm. In any event, though, the end of the line, there seems to be a physical difference. Small. It's not, if you're looking for it, you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a big, red tea.
Which is why they're just finding it now.
But just
probably, you know. I'm guessing.
So, but I would say that again, the issue seems to be complicated culturally by our culture's encouragement of all kinds of experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual in particular, even wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying. I was babysitting for two of my grandchildren who are in town on Sunday, and their neighbor, the kid is a boy, but he was wearing a skirt, and he's about 5 years old. And the face and the haircut couldn't pass for either. So, but his brothers were calling him he.
Mm-hmm.
So then I spoke to my daughter-in-law, and I said, I'm just wondering, he likes to dress that way. Mm-hmm. So I just told her about Zamir, I mean my grandson, over my dead body. Mm-hmm. I would not encourage, she said, but you know, West Philly, people experiment and so on. I'm with the Torah on this, you know, very clear. Gendered divisions. That doesn't mean that pants haven't become a female garb. That's a whole other issue.
Emily, you don't mean to imply that there isn't a significant percentage of the transgender population that has nothing to do with how their moms dressed them when they were five, right?
No. One of the things that I've heard, they've had interviews with these parents, that the youngest one is either 3 or 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little girl who said, I am a boy,
right.
and kept insisting on that. And anyway, they are now calling the child a he. They've gone through to, there are now clinics that specialize in dealing with children to see what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
And this child, the child stopped eating, I mean, did all sorts of things to indicate how unhappy the child was, based on that they determined that it was the gender thing, because everything else was okay, except the kid kept saying, I'm a he.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I'm just commenting that I wonder to what degree experimentation and all sorts of things contributes to people.
That's part of the debate in culture, is to what extent is that experimentation, has that increased or impacted the incident, or has it exposed the incidents that was already prevalent? That's the debate that we're
having.
See,
the film, if anybody saw it, I don't know if you saw it, the Danish girl. I resisted, and then people told me it was really terrific, and I went to see it. And apparently it's based on the real life of the first transgender person in the 1920s who did have surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So here he is, he's a man, he's married, they show that he's very happy sexually with his wife, and she comes home one time with a particular lingerie, and he's just very engaged by this lingerie. And he starts touching it. In short, apropos of expose, or he starts to wear it under his suit,
mm-hmm.
and eventually he feels that this is his real self.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what really happened, but would you say that if his wife never brought home this seductive lingerie, he wouldn't have discovered the she in himself? I don't know.
Well, that's the movie version. So.
That's the movie, and that's the movie version. Right?
It's don't confuse it with
that. No. And it's very poignant. You see his mm-hmm. stages of
evolution, self awareness.
But it makes me uncomfortable that there's so much encouragement in the general culture for sexual experimentation.
But wearing a skirt on a five-year-old is not sexual experimentation.
I know, but I have to say viscerally.
And I think there's a counter-argument to be made that not letting the five-year-old wear the skirt
would be
much worse,
making
a big deal, like when my kids were little and my daughter would play dress-up. My son would put the skirt on. My mother-in-law was horrified. And I said, this will only create a problem if you make an issue of it. And I meant,
no, look at it. And you're saying some of the guys get dressed up as women.
But I think the critical piece for me for takeaway is Emily said, over my dead body for my grandson. All that being true, the visceral, the thing
that
she
right.
felt deep
right.
inside in the pit of her stomach
that's right.
is what we're talking about humanly as response. And so, I totally get what you're saying and where you're coming from. And then I know
this
in the world that we live in and in our community, and I think the same could be said because this is such a small percentage of the population, I think for us, in terms of informing and discussing homosexuality, is a more central issue, because we're going to be dealing with that in 10 years, whereas transgender, the percentage we're going to be dealing with will be be so small, but it's still critical.
No, but Lisa's right in the sense that there's a new research that shows that different people are wired differently, and that has a lot to do with our culture wars.
Do you mean response or the people who are acting on?
I mean people. Not the transgender population. I mean just how we think about change and how we think about, you know, all these kinds of things. That some people are more wired toward valuing tradition and separation. And
you're using wired in a nature way, as in a biological.
That's what they think.
Really?
I think so. And that part of that is part of the reason for our culture wars. There is a really influential work. I don't think he says it on a biological sense, but this guy Jonathan Haidt wrote this very influential book. What's that? I forget the name of the book. Anyone know this book I'm referring to?
I know.
It's an attempt to account for our culture wars. Yes. And why we can't agree on anything in our society. Why is it that we're divided 50-50? Why is it that we could be at each other's necks all day long and we talk at each other instead of to each other? And like, in other words, where does that come from? Why is that? And it's sort of like this idea that in the history of humanity there have been different impulses and that different people are just simply attracted to a different set of values. Some people are, you know, more toward compassion and other people more toward law. I mean, these are, if I were to ask you, like, what are the underlying dynamics in our political disputes for today, right? Today, it's these kinds of things. He identifies six. I forget the mind, something with the mind. I forget the title of the book. It's really made the rounds. It's
The Righteous Mind.
Thank you. By Haidt. It's an extremely important book. And this is sort of like it's what we're picking up on now. It's that different people have different visceral reactions, and that if you multiply that, you know, enough times over, you have America today. But I don't mean that this particular, but I mean like those kinds of dynamics in our society. And this is an attempt to account for how that is and where that's come from.
And you hear the physical reaction, and that's what I'm always listening for. And it's usually one that involves the stomach and feeling nauseated or you know, and that's like.
So he talks about that. There's actually disgust. Not Emily, but I'm saying
Emily.
Not Emily at all. Actually, not Emily at all.
No, but homosexuality, male versus female. There's an innate feeling of being sick from it. That is really interesting.
I don't know if it's universal.
No, but you will hear. But what I'm saying is that I think that's related to this, whatever you're talking about, that we have that we're on the spectrum.
Right. What Haidt is suggesting is that different people tend to be animated by a different set of core values, and that traditionalists or conservatives versus liberals, like that's just kind of human nature to be wired differently in terms of embracing different sets of these values. And once they're so basic, they're so fundamental to who we are and how we think, that we tend not to even have self-awareness as to how we are wired, because these are just evident truths to us. Mm-hmm. And therefore the other side is really just not only wrong, but is unimaginable, not just objectionable, and that makes it very difficult to have a dialogue and build a society together.
Simultaneously, I just want to say that as it happens, I have met three transgender people in my life, two personally in conversation. One of them totally looked like a man, and then mentioned that born as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Both two of them just lovely neshamas. They were just lovely, lovely people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not disgusted when I mm-hmm. heard that about them.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was just written up in the Jerusalem Post, because she comes from a Hasidic family.
Yeah, I heard about this.
She's just love. She's so winning. Such an mm-hmm. personality. There's something about her. Blah, blah, blah. The point is that I think also we would become more comfortable with atypical people if we had more personal contact, because we would see that they are.
It's true in our political culture as well.
In the Orthodox world, though, when there is so much gender segregation, mm-hmm. the adjustment, I would imagine, would be much more difficult, because you you know, there mm-hmm. isn't gender integration in mm-hmm. every facet. As, mm-hmm. And the more segregated, the more of a...
I think also, yeah.
The other.
And the comfort
of
talking about health.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, when do you change from the Talmud class with the boys to the...
Right. Yeah, I think also there are a number of halakhic questions that come up which increase the opportunity, for lack of a better term, for difficult questions and experiences to arise. So if I don't sit on either side, if I have mixed pews, then I don't have to think twice about right. where I'm going to sit.
Right.
But all of a sudden, if I have gender separation, then I need to make an active decision.
Yes,
or a shul, right?
And it's public. So it's,
yeah, it could exacerbate matters in that way, too.
I didn't see it here, and I was told about it. I didn't see it. A former, and I think it's the most previous... president of the OU mm-hmm. spoke in California.
Did I have around this?
It is here. I'm sorry.
No, I might not have. I don't know. I saw the article. I saw and read the article.
Oh, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know
well, let me. About. Yeah, let me talk about that quickly. And I also want to move along so that we can get through it. Exactly right. Not exactly right. It was Rabbi Weinrib. Rabbi Weinrib is the former. Executive Vice President, I think the title, or the Executive Vice President Emeritus, or something along those lines of the OU. He also has a background in mental health. He's, I believe, is a psychiatrist. I want to say he definitely has long experience as a mental health professional. And he was in LA for the last couple of years. I'm not sure exactly when he spoke about these things. I guess no one else in LA was willing to touch it. I don't know. He spoke 90 minutes at one of the shuls there, question answer session, the whole nine yards, and was written up in the Jewish Journal, I think is the name of the newspaper out there. It's an interesting article. I thought it was telling. I listened to one shiur online, and I listened by a well-known Orthodox rabbi who spoke on these issues, and I read that and any number of other things, and it was interesting to see the comparison, and I really felt that his mental health background helps inform the conversation in a really important kind of way. So that's just my experience with that. Now, obviously, this has come back. The issues, the concerns of suicidality goes out without saying that those are essential. The value of human life is of infinite or ultimate significance. Goes without saying in our tradition. In source 6 at the bottom, I gave you the charge to save human life. So it goes without saying that if we have a population that's suffering in this kind of way, that's obviously of more than just a significant concern. I'm not going to spend too much time on it now, but I just wanted to point out there are larger philosophical questions. This is obviously a human question, and there are obviously sort of instinctive responses that we have to this that we're discussing, but there are obviously philosophical questions as well about gender, about how tight those differences are. We live in a world where, at least in more recent history, the sort of operative assumption until the sexual revolution was in a much more strict separation of how we view genders and how we think about it. In the 60s and 70s, things have been changing at a really rapid pace. It's far from the first time in the history of humanity where these distinctions have been questioned, right? Certainly in Roman times and other epochs in human history, there have been questions. And even today, there are other cultures. In India, I believe there's a third gender. And these are not... these are to some degree, this is also true in the West. And it's really interesting to get out of the box and look at other cultures. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but there is an understanding that there's a complexity to gender. Western civilization has been overwhelmed by the complexification of gender categories over the last 40 years, and we are not even close to figuring this out. We are confounded, frankly. We are confused. We have no idea where to go with any of this. And homosexuality and transvestite behavior and transgenderism is just, it's just really the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are so many different categories of sexual identity, of sexual preference, of sexual self-presentation. It goes on and on. Each one has different categories. In other words, you can be one, you can be the other, you can have a little bit of both, you can identify as neither, you can identify sometimes as one, sometimes as the other. You can be torn about your identity, and there is just, you know, then multiplied by each of these categories, it's the complexity is almost endless. And there are terms that are being developed for each of these. LGBT is an extremely limited acronym that's convenient, but it doesn't encompass all the different sexual categories that are being discussed in today's culture, which I think is really quite telling. The fact that on the one hand, and the question is, what philosophy does Judaism have on this? And this, by the way, goes to the women's issues also to some degree. Does Judaism believe in a strict gender segregation, or is there sort of an understanding that actually, to some extent, that is a cultural construct? That's one of the major sort of underlying philosophical issues that sort of no one discusses because we're too busy, intelligent fashion, we're too busy arguing with ourselves as a community, which is really just sickening already and needs to change. Be that as it may, if you want to ask it from a philosophical standpoint, the fact that God created on the one hand separate genders, but that at the same time there is a midrashic tradition that, if you might have seen this, that Adam and Eve were du partzufim, right? That one face on one side, one side on the other, one face on the other, and the possibility that God fashioned woman out of that, right? Out of that being, out of that entity, and separated us out, I think is extremely suggestive and important in terms of this conversation. You could, of course, take it in two different ways. You can understand that in rather two opposite plausible interpretations of that, I think. One is that you see that there was some sort of mixing from the outset. And the opposite, the alternative interpretation is that no, despite that, right, God was, it was a symbolic way of saying these are completely separate. And again, you can interpret as you wish. It's not going to resolve the debate, it will just anchor it in a textual discussion, but I think that that's an important piece of this conversation. I gave that to you in sources 7, 8, and 9.
Brishit was very well written. This is a
harm
of
Nekevah. What? Brishit
was very well written. You know, that phrase works.
Right. Well, it's intentional ambiguity
exactly.
is what it is. Right. Is it Zacharu Nekevah or is it Zachar, right?
Yeah. So
it's terrific.
So, well, it's, right. The literary scholars. The literary scholars that see this as delicious. I think. Right? And there's, right? I mean, this is endless, right? I mean, you can try. This is good. The Kuzari, actually, believe it or not, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the great medieval scholar and philosopher, toward the end, the latter part, not the very end, but the fourth or the fifth seconds of the Kuzari, actually suggests, and I think it was based on a common medieval belief, although I don't know the history of it, Dr. Eddie Reichman, who's going to be coming, he's one of our scholars coming in May, he is an expert in the history of medicine. So in other words, he's an expert in rabbinics. Mm-hmm. So in other words, when you read a 12th century rabbinic text or a 19th century rabbinic text, a responsum or something like that, and they describe the anatomy, you know, in a particular kind of way. So most, you know, and rabbis nowadays don't know what to do with that because we know about anatomy as it's taught maybe in our classes today. You can ask a scientist who knows, or a medical practitioner, they'll know what they teach in modern medical schools, but they don't necessarily know what the Maharal thought, right, in the 16th century. He knows that. He's actually studied much of the history of medicine within, as it was understood within the rabbinic tradition, drawing on the general medical assumptions of his day. This is very, very cool. So I have to ask him actually about this Kuzari. He's fascinating. From my time at Einstein, when we were the Rabbi Einstein, we became very friendly. So he's a wonderful human being. He's at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. But he writes broadly on these kinds of topics. Anyhow, so the Kuzari actually suggests that we don't generally accept this nowadays, that the male and female anatomy are the same but inverted somehow. Don't ask me what that means. I don't understand the medical history of it. But I think if you were trying to extrapolate philosophical conclusions, I think it's a very interesting kind of text. Right? That would seem to conflate some of the differences among genders, which is ironic for a middle-aged scholar of the Middle Ages to write in that way. But I think that that's just an interesting thing. Again, what do I make of that? Do I take it that there's sharp, right, that there's some sort of, you know, overlap or something like that, there's more fluidity than we might otherwise think? Or do I say, no, that was just based on the medicine of his day? But maybe, right, is it the medicine joke, the philosophy? Is that the philosophy encouraged him to embrace a certain medical understanding. It's hard to know. Those are very different analytical approaches, and they end up with opposite conclusions.
There have been studies on psychological, philosophical, / on implications of women's sexuality as being interior and taking in,
right,
as distinct from male sexuality, which, yeah, expresses itself as external.
So there's a, yeah. So I do know things along is actually helps with things along. There's a large capitalistic literature that bears on these issues, and there are a couple of pieces to this. Number one, capitalistic literature tends to have an essentialist distinction, not like this. An essentialist reading of the difference between male and female in many, many ways, and one of them is this: that the male is considered to be the giver, the woman is considered to be the recipient. The physical dimensions of intimacy lead Kabbalah to say this, right? That there's the giver and that there's the receiver, and makes a big deal out of it. That's not just the way that we were created, but that reflects a larger worldview. That's one thing. The other thing I just learned this recently in the Kabbalistic literature, again, I don't fully understand it, but there is a belief in the Kabbalistic literature, hold your breath for this, that human beings can switch gender midlife.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
This is a belief in the Kabbalistic literature. I kid you not. Sometimes it's viewed as a punishment for certain sins. Sometimes it's viewed because of whatever set of experiences, God gives you a different mission. Something changes midlife. So for instance, I gave you just one. What?
It's not a reward.
It's not, right? The Kaf HaChayim in Source 11. Rav Chaim Pelagi was a great Kabbalist. He writes this on the bottom four lines of the piece that I gave you on the left column. He says, Da, it's about the fourth, after all the acronyms there, it says, Da, no, ki ha'adam. Afal pi shehu zachar, even though, let's say, a person is male, yish mini aviro, there are certain kinds of sins, shegormim lo lihitapeh liyot nekeva, that cause an individual to become female. Wow, transgenderism before it was all the rage. V'inyan echad, he's a 19th century scholar, just for context. V'inyan echad hu, right, and he actually connects it to Mishkav Zachor and all sorts of things. He says the same thing is true of a Gentile, whatever, it's the whole thing. It's an essentialist reading.
It all goes in one direction.
I was wondering about that. I don't know. I understand exactly where you're going, and you might well be right. You might be right in terms of how pre-moderns view this, but I don't know. Now, we haven't even, we're late on time, I want to make sure to cover a little bit more. We haven't even begun to discuss the halakhic ramifications, but the good news is... I should have told you to come in at 11:35. Touche.
No, that was really impressive.
It's all good, don't worry.
That was a really impressive sweep of...
No worries. Yeah, I promise, but we're not done.
It happened here, and then you're able to do that.
Yeah.
For us, it's a great role model and
thank
inspiration.
You. I appreciate it. Thank you. And a good save, but I appreciate it. I know it's genuine, too. It's all good. The halakhic issues are many. The good news or the bad news or just the news is that they're, believe it or right, as you would expect, they're being worked out as we speak. I mean, there's no consensus on these issues. They've been discussed seriously in the literature for about 17 years, and I say 17 years, that's actually a relatively long period of time thinking about these issues. There was a book, I think it was that Dor Tzav Buchot, which I gave you here, which was the breakthrough book in the field. It's on, that gave you the picture of the cover page on page 7. Sefer Dor Tzav Buchot, V'suya Nituchim Aktualiyim B'Halakha. It sounds like, on the outside, it's just Nituchim Aktualiyim means realistic or, you know, commonplace surgeries. Nituach is a modern word for surgery, but it means the plastic surgery when it comes to gender change. This is an entire sefer, 300 pages, dedicated to the subject of the halacha of transgenderism and gender change. And the questions that he addresses are many, many, many. What? Is an Israeli Haredi author. That's all I know. And beat everyone else to the punch. And he discusses any number of issues, both pre-surgery, the legitimacy, halachic legitimacy of the surgery and the effect of the surgery, whether or not it's permissible in the first place. Where do you sit in terms of like the mechitza kind of questions, yichud and ikia? I mean, the questions are endless. They overlap tremendously with homosexual questions. So there's plenty of overlap and identical, but there's a lot of similarity, and that's one set of issues. It's fair to say that the consensus of poskim is that as you'd expect, that the feeling that one has, the sense of identity that one has, is not considered determinative by poskim in of itself, and that's probably what you would expect. And that is indeed the consensus of all poskim that I have seen. What about the surgery itself? Well, that raises a whole other set of questions. Now, as opposed to homosexual behavior, there is no arayos. We're not talking about illicit relations. That's not what we're talking about. And the question here is not about once I've had surgery, about being together with someone. That's not even what we're talking about right now. We're talking about the legitimacy of undergoing the surgical procedure itself. What is the surgical procedure? Well, first of all, there's the infusion of hormones as preparation for the surgery. And then it is, as someone said, is plastic surgery. It is plastic surgery. One's underlying anatomy remains fundamentally intact for the most part.
You mean internal?
Like ovary, right. Yeah. The internal stuff, right? Anything that's internal. The goal is to allow someone to experience their everyday life, including the intimate everyday life, as best they can as a member of the gender with which they identify. By the way, an unspoken piece of this is the expenses involved in the surgery. It is prohibitive. It's not the same. I forget which way it's more expensive, I guess. And to become a woman, I think it's more expensive. There's more that they do. But it's tens and tens of thousands of dollars. And by the way, it's, you know, in terms of the insurance piece, is going to be the next battle at some point. We're going to get there.
There's also a question of, does the taxpayer pick up the tab? And that was an issue with that fellow, Bradley, who was
interesting.
In the army, and he insisted on...
The army is also the next battle line, also. Transgender is still not permitted in the military.
And in the end, Obama approved the taxpayer's expense to have the procedure.
In other words, the VA covered it.
Yeah.
So the halakha permissibility of undergoing the surgery is not a rayos, but there are many, many areas of potential prohibition that come up in this conversation. One is sirus, to become a eunuch, right? It's prohibited biblically for a man and perhaps less stringently for a woman, but still prohibited in Shulchan Aruch obviously if one's life is in danger and they need to tie their tubes, obviously that's something that one is not only permissible, but it's mandatory in halacha in order to ensure the safety. But all things being equal, that's not permissible in halacha. That's one issue. We mentioned earlier the issue of cross-dressing. So that he brings to bear as well. I'll give you some of these sources on the bottom of page 7. Engaging in any sort of surgery that is physically harms or impacts one in a dramatic way is known as chavala, not causing injury to oneself. Any elective surgery sometimes has the potential to involve, right? Any surgery involves the potential of danger, and so that's also been brought as a piece of this in the conversation. It's ironic, this one, source 16, is the fourth halachic considerations brought to bear. It's about ensuring one's health. I mean, it's true that when you undergo surgery, there's a danger anytime you're in general anesthesia or whatever, what have you, and a significant surgery, there's no question. And elective plastic surgery in general, halacha frowns upon unless someone has terrible scars, burns, and so on and so forth. That's a different, or there's a physical reason. That's already a different situation. But you know, if it's just a everyday case, I'm not comfortable with how I look. I'm a little different. Right? Halacha is generally extremely uncomfortable with that kind of thing. And so, nishmartim al nafshei seichem, physical health is brought to bear here also. You know, the mental health argument on the converse, of course, is could be brought to bear as well. So these are just four. The author actually lists 8 bases for prohibition. And I should say that the general consensus of poskim is that the surgery is not halachically permissible. One piece that I am struggling with is that I heard one particular rabbi give a shiur on this topic that was recorded. And he said just this. And he said, And I saw another author who wrote on this issue a number of years ago. This is already also probably 15 years ago. And that other author said, but what about the possibility that it could be life or death? What if a mental health professional comes and says, this is a life and death issue for this individual? So one author said, and this is completely perplexing to me. I don't understand that. This is what the rabbi wrote. He said that that in his opinion, he says he doesn't believe the medical experts. It's not possible. He says, come and prove it to me. I don't understand. I don't think that that's how we operate. What does that mean? We rely on medical experts. Judaism very much believes in mental health as a serious mental ailment. And, maybe that goes to this, like, the kishkas. Maybe that's really, it was the miskishkas. They just couldn't see allowing this. It's just pritzos. So you can't do it. Okay, but when lives are at stake, you have to face the issue squarely. Another rabbi, he just kind of gave the shiur, and he has an excellent shiur, and he said, like, the safer list is 8 prohibitions. That's consensus of all poskim. One might raise the question about pikuach nefesh. He had real cases. There were real issues that he had. He spoke with a major, major posik. Major posik said that, but we don't do it. We just don't do it. And he said, but there's this pikuach nefesh question of life and death in certain cases. And the rabbi just, that's not what the posik said to do. I don't know. When I saw the write-up of what's his name? The rabbi I just mentioned was in L.A., Rabbi Weinrib. He was poor. I don't know. I didn't hear the class. I wasn't there, and I didn't hear a recording. The write-up indicated that he might have seen it differently. But if the doctors say that either you have the surgery or this person will, in all likelihood, or it's quite plausible, will literally carry it and go ahead with suicide, that might be a different scenario. I don't know what the percentages of cases are. I just know that there's a lot of life and death questions that are real and that people are confronting. This major poster has questions from all over the world on all sorts of issues. Says that he gets questions about transgender 2 to 3 times a week now. Okay, so that's right. I mean, if that's accurate, we're talking about 100 to 150 shadows on this topic a year for a leading posik.
I'll bet a lot of parents talk to him.
That's aside from the counseling or the pastoral piece, and they're calling him for halachic guidance, what to do. Right? Unbelievable. What is the effect of the... Let's say someone goes ahead with it. Is it according to halacha? What's the gender? So this is a person whose internal organs are the same that this individual started. There are some significant changes. We're not going through all the medical side of it. But obviously, either way, you won't be able to bear children. And that's a given. And there are some physical differences, but the internal organs are fundamentally the same, and it's the external appearances that are different. Obviously, the genetics don't change either. The hormonal percentages do change, although we would probably think it's unlikely that in of itself would be determinative. So is the surgery halachically effective? Someone who has undergone this surgery, where does this individual sit? You know, the whole gamut of questions. Can you imagine? By the way, the other question is, does it matter? Meaning, if it comes to questions of tzniut, sometimes questions of tzniut depends not on actual fundamental sexual identity, but on the perception. So if the halacha of mechitza, can you imagine, it's a brave new world kind of questions, if mechitza depends not on the actual essential gender of an individual, but rather the perceived gender of an individual, then maybe the tzniut would demand that that person be on the safe. If I transition from a man to a woman, even if you think halachically I'm a man, maybe I should still sit on the women's side.
That's what Rabbi
Weinrib, Rabbi Lee Paskin, and that's not an uncommon talk. I don't know what the consensus, or if there is a consensus at this point, but for certain tzniut-related types of related matters, there is such a view, which can ease things, doesn't philosophically ease things, but eases things in terms of the actual lived experience for this individual who wants to transition. You can see that.
As a general perspective, then, the halacha would seem not to focus on the genetics or the chromosomal identity, but on the physical.
No, absolutely not. No. On the essential question, meaning those are exceptional circumstances due to tzniut, but if you're asking what is the halachic gender of this individual, I would answer it as follows, just in terms of surveying the field. The majority view among poskim is that the surgery does not change the gender. minority view of Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, the great postdoc of Shari Tzedek Hospital until his passing about a decade ago, whatever it was. Waldenberg believed that it does change the gender, that it is effective. Mm-hmm. He thought it was usher, as a general matter, but that if someone went ahead with it, then it would be effective and change the gender. So the majority view is that fundamentally the person remains the same gender, but that there are certain halachot that do not depend on my gender, but rather on the perception of my gender.
But let's walk this back a little bit and away from, because that might inform things, away from the transgender question.
Sure.
And somebody who has a specific, you know, sexual appearance that suggests a gender,
mm-hmm.
but the genetics are discordant with that, because that's
just the pure, genetics.
Yeah,
but in every other possible way, even the internal organs.
Well, the internal organs may or may not.
But that's going to be key. In other words, I think I would say if the person is in all ways a particular gender, right, that's, but the genetics pull in a different direction, then I would say the opposite, that the majority view there would probably be that that person is, right, is the gender that, in other words, the majority view is that we don't look at the genetics. The majority view is that we look at the internal organs of the person, basically, and that would be determinative in one way or the other. That's what I would say.
So that's what I'm saying.
And that's true, and then even post-surgery, since you haven't changed those internal, it's really plastic surgery. Right, so
cosmetic, you mean?
It's right, exactly. So, you know, as such, the changes to the hormones and to the physical outward appearances are unlikely, according to Poskim, to change the essence of the person. Although, again, Tzitz Eliezer does not seem to Poskim that way, which is very intriguing.
Okay, so what I think I'm hearing from this is, leaving aside the transgender question, that, you know, it basically goes by what appears to be sexually, internally, externally, for most post-scheme. And in terms of this, you know, the surgery or hormones without the surgery, if there's a perception that a person is of one gender, mm-hmm. there are at least some post-scheme who, although that person remains their birth gender, at least some post-scheme would suggest that for, you know, public things, like which side of the mechitza to sit on, mm-hmm. or things like that, that mm-hmm. It would look really strange for someone who looks like a woman to sit in the men's section or vice versa, so they, you know, avoid that issue by sitting.
Right, but that's all right. I would just add, I don't think that they're not presenting it as avoiding the issue, they're presenting it as actually halachically consistent.
Yeah.
That there's some
halachic. I'm not saying avoid the but I'm saying you don't want to have somebody who looks like a woman
sitting in the
men's section.
It has the effect of easing matters in terms of people's experience when they walk into shul. That is true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It's a good thing. Whatever. It does ease it, though, that's for sure. And it can ease things for the person who just wants to already just be on it, right?
Let somebody pass, so to speak.
Right, and it's kind of a way of like kind of having your cake and eating it too. We're not going to say that we feel a lot, you know, we're not going to say that, you know, we're going to change your gender on the basis of a plastic surgery, but we are going to say that halacha is able to create a public scenario in which we can accommodate this and not allow it to you to experience that torture in that way necessarily.
Or the community to experience that discomfort if somebody can pass.
Right.
It's hard for me to say, I mean, it goes back to earlier discussions,
yeah. So, you know, do we want the community to experience discomfort or not? You know, that's complicated.
And we couldn't be basing halachic decisions on that, because that wouldn't be...
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the effect of this decision rather than the impetus for it. That's correct. Yeah, that's pretty much where the field stands now. Obviously, if we went into every single detail, you know, we'd be here for another couple of classes. I think that that's where the current trend is to, because it's workable, right? It's like it's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect, but it's workable in terms of like the external halachic pieces to it. And that's sort of where things stand now. You know, to me, the big, you know, or a big issue that I'm really thinking about is this question of the surgery for the person who is, you know, the doctors are coming and report it, you know, the therapists are saying this is life and death. And you know, where is, you know, where is halacha and where are the poskim standing on that issue? And that's something I'm struggling with and trying to understand, because I don't understand the halachic logic of someone who would say that it's prohibited. I'm really just from a purely halachic perspective, it's hard for me to understand that. So that's something I'm thinking through. But yes, that's kind of where the field is currently standing.
Just wanted to say about the piece, about where to sit and show, that can raise other issues, because from what the little I understand about it, gender identity isn't necessarily correlated with sexual inclination, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another piece. It might be easier for a homosexual than that's, and that is absolutely
right.
That
could be opening a whole other kind of wound.
That is, that is absolutely correct. And it's hard because in an easy world, then everyone it's the same. But here, you might have there might be a discrepancy between the quote unquote needs, as it were, of this individual versus the rest of the people there.
Right.
It's almost irreconcilable, and it's like the third bathroom. What are you going to do? Create a third section within the chitza? Okay. A trichitza, they call it.
And it's not necessarily a surgical question, because someone can have, you know, the perception of being of one gender based just on hormonal therapy. It doesn't necessarily require surgery.
Right. And by the way, there's a significant amount of the population that has gender dysphoria that does not, they don't immediately recommend surgery, not only for financial reasons, but for lots of obvious reasons. And they generally start with the hormonal treatments and try to see if that is sufficient. Therapy, et cetera.
But even that may not be so black and white, because I mean, I think also, you know, just in terms of, I think it's actually much simpler than a situation where, you know, there's a therapeutic consensus that the person is a suicidal risk if they don't undergo surgery. I think in most, it is more likely that the situation will be different opinions, which of course makes the halachic issue, you know, if one wanted to argue pikuach nefesh, much more
generally speaking
complex. And then additionally, you know, Emily was talking about children before. There's a certain, and you know, some reading that I've done on the topic, there's a certain amount of gender exploration, you know, that's normal and typical. And you know,
and that's part.
And there's a lot of a debate, you know, in terms of the pediatric literature as to whether or not one should allow a child to transition or not, because you know there are many situations where that settles, and of course there are other situations where it doesn't.
That's
so
The question. You're absolutely right. The question of how early to intervene and how to handle that with children,
but it's very tricky. I think. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm a cardiologist, but thinking of it as a medical
perspective,
you know, the question of pikuach nefesh in a situation like this is not a straightforward issue. I think if it were clear, it would really, you know, help a decision halachically, but it's not, I don't think.
I'm just talking about in a pure halachic sense, I'm just saying if you had such a scenario, right, then what would you do? But I agree that it's surely more
complex. You said something just a moment ago of separating gender identity versus sexual
preference.
Yes, and the only two transgender people I know were married and had discussions with the spouse to maintain the marriage. And I mean, I certainly didn't have, you know, I didn't have discussions with them about, you know, the physical relationships, but clearly they stayed in the same partnership, which I guess is kind of interesting.
But I saw that the literature that I saw, but it was very limited, suggested that there's, quote, no correlation. That was the language that I saw.
Interesting. I would have thought.
That's what I saw.
I guess what I'm saying is that raises serious issues. Obviously, walking in terms of homosexual health issues. But.
Fair enough. Good. So again, these are kind of conversations that we're all thinking through, and so I appreciate the opportunity to come together. So we're going to stop here.